This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where we explore meaning in movies together.
What's up, universe? It is your boy back with another episode of A Lost Plot. As always, I am your host, Maverick, and here we have back with us our co-host, Avalon. Thanks for being back.
Hello, hola, konnichiwa, and leho again.
He's a regular for a reason, and today's reason is Dune Part 2. That's right, the most recent release, ya boys, from the Dune series, yeah. Anyways, I'm a fan of this series, in case people did not know this. I have read all of Frank Herbert's books. I have not read all of his son and Kevin J. Anderson's books, Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson's, but does not matter because today we're not talking about those books. We're talking about the movie based on the original book by Frank Herbert known as Dune, but this is part two of that. We already saw part one earlier on. It's the American science fiction space opera written. The screenplay was written by Denis Villeneuve and John Spates. It's directed by Denis Villeneuve. Again, if I'm saying his name wrong. My bad. Starring Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides, Zendaya as Shani, Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica, Stellan Skarsgård as Vladimir Harkonnen, Javier Bardem as Stilgar, and the rest. It's got quite the crew. But before we get into the dirty details today, Avalon, please tell us what we need to know. What's going on?
Before I get into that, I feel like I have to ask you a question. Is your fandom of Dune more than Lord of the Rings or less than?
That's an interesting question. I would probably say Lord of the Rings is higher, just because I have actually read more of Lord of the Rings, that just based on pure knowledge of the universe. Mm-hmm. Because there's the Lord of the Rings books, there's The Hobbit, then there's The Children of Húrin, there's the Book of Lost Tales, Book of Lost Tales 2, The Bay of Belfast. Like, there's all these other ancillary pieces that I've really delved into to try to know the universe, and I'm not even a full knowledgeable person in that one. I feel more knowledgeable about Dune simply because I've read more of the books than the average person has compared to the people I know who read Lord of the Rings, who are far more into it than I am. So I do like the series. I think the series overall takes a very interesting look at the space science fiction universe. Mm-hmm. But it's not to say it doesn't have flaws, of course. So I would say if you're reading the books, I probably wouldn't go past book four of Frank Herbert's books. If you're a really big fan, you can. But, you know, anyways, this is the movie. We're talking about the movie.
So I had to ask, especially okay. After you hyped it. All right. This movie follows the events of the first movie, part one. Paul and his mother follows Paul and his mother as they flee into Fremen territory and take refuge among them and join their battle for the deliverance of their home planet Arrakis. Mm-hmm. As they join the fight, though, as things continue, the prophecies regarding Muad'Dib gain traction and force Paul to consider whether he is their messiah or not. All the while, political forces move for both Harkonnen and the Emperor to solidify the control of the planet and the spice produced there. Yeah. So, it's a rough summary.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, it's a pretty complicated universe, so there's a
and
lot
it's a very
going
complicated
on.
Plot.
Yeah, especially because unlike other stories like such as Star Wars, or even to a certain degree like Lord of the Rings, there is, at the end of the day, it can be boiled down to some level of simplicity, especially at least for the originals for Star Wars, where it's the Empire versus the Rebellion, a fight of the small guy versus the big guy who's the clear evil, or, you know, the Sauron's evil forces versus everyone else in Middle Earth, right? At the end of the day, you can kind of boil it down pretty simply. This one gets, I would say Dune as a whole is a lot of intrigue, a lot of political maneuvering, and that's even within the houses amongst each other, not just against the Fremen in the Dune universe. So it's known for its politics and for being a rather complex environment. So that makes it a little more complicated. Anyways, Your rating. What do you give it? You looked at the 9 points and you said, this one gets...
So when I did the review, my review came to 6.75. And however, I would also like to add something. Because I was looking about it and thinking about this movie, my review, my score is just based on this movie on its own. Like, I'm not counting part one, because I'm just thinking of this, the review, my score would probably be a little different and probably be higher if I'm including the first movie. I decided to make my score just solely based on this movie, part two.
Yeah, and I will say that is generally, I think, the best way to go about things. I think it's a lot safer to do just the one, and I don't... Yeah, I would have to think about how they do that. Obviously, you don't usually watch a part two without watching part one. So, anyways.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think most people who watch part two would have already seen the first movie. But I felt like I should review this movie as its own. Like, say some random person comes across this movie, how would they rate it on its own kind of thing? So that does take some things, make things a little different when rating it.
Right. But. And some of those things that you're looking at for... like what bleeds into between it, when you are taking into account other movies, what sections of the review actually take into account previous movies, really only like the first three questions, which is like a point and a half, really take in.
Well, actually I'd argue differently, but we'll get into that. But
sure. Okay. That's fair. Yeah, I based mine purely off of this movie as well, and my rating was a 6.6 out of 9.
Oh, wow, so, you got lower than me.
So, that being said, it is cinematically an awesome movie. If you don't know about
there are some amazing fight scenes, some amazing visual effects in this movie. Like, just based on that alone, like, the movie is worth watching just for those.
From just pure cinematography and the aspects of building a masterful universe, it's an awesome movie in that regard. We're not reviewing that kind of stuff on this podcast. This is all about the plot line. So
yeah, another thing to say about this movie, which I didn't even notice till I was researching the movie afterwards today. So apparently the director has a huge beef with dialogue in movies and shows and such. And so I didn't think about this, but like, there's a lot of visual scenes in this movie because he likes to show things happening rather than telling them. So he's a big proponent of show, don't tell, which when I think about that, there's a lot of things that when you have that mindset, you get to realize, oh, there's a lot more, like you get to understand the thinking behind some of the scenes in the movie.
That would also explain some other things in the movie. Like, just as a side, also, some of the characters, I don't think they get their name mentioned like once in the entire movie, and then you never hear it again. And so as an audience, me being knowledgeable about the universe, knew who these characters were. But if you don't hear like Princess Ireland's name, you don't know who she actually is. You just know, oh, she's the princess. That's it. You know, that happened a couple times, I think, in this movie. So be aware of that kind of stuff. We're going to push forward, go into the review, because that's why you all are here. So that opening scene, as we always start with, they reintroduce us to the characters. What did you think of the reintroduction to Dune, the reintroduction of Paul, of Shawnee, of the bad guys? You know, what did you think?
Well, it picks up where the first movie left off, where like they're going into the desert. It picks up with them being like, it's a tense scene where they're hiding, the Fremen and Paul and his mother. And it looks like Harkonnen hunters, or like they're hiding from them as the Harkonnens are searching the area. So like it starts with like this tense situation that ends in a battle and death and more world building. Because it's showing how much they value water.
Yeah, that's true. I was curious as a reader of the books how they were going to use that, if it was just going to be a small part. But they really show you their idea of what it looked like to extract the water from the dead bodies. I thought that was kind of interesting, kind of cool. World building.
Well, also just further establishes the value of water on this planet. I mean, even when she's like, his mom's gonna throw up, he's like, don't. Just the whole like mentality is like, don't do that. That's wasteful.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Don't throw up because it's rude. Don't throw up because you're wasting the throw up.
Yeah.
That was the, yeah. Anyways, it shows, it's true. And that's a show don't tell type of thing as well. Right. So they started off, I think, pretty well at just reestablishing where they were. And it does, like you said, pick up right where it left off from the last one. You're literally still carrying the body of, I think it's Jameis or whoever it was that he fought in the duel at the end of the last one. So clear reintegration there. I thought it was pretty good. I mean, it wasn't the most amazing open era I've seen, but I didn't expect that. So it got solid points and, you know, the world building was good. In regards to Paul, especially in this movie, did you think he was a compelling character with flaws or fears that drove him?
Yes. And I would say, like, he, like, even though, like, there's this whole talk of fear and, like, not letting fear control you or something, there is scenes where fear clearly does control him, where it's like he is fighting fear and, like, but he's, like, he's trying to, like, make the right decision. Like, he's seeing the future and he sees how his actions could lead, like, at all these different possibilities, and he's like trying to prevent all the bad ones from happening, and it's like that fear is like keeping him from like taking certain actions and from doing certain things. Like, he's just constantly pigeonholing himself, like, I have to do this because if I do this other thing, people will die or genocide will happen or the Harkonnens will win. So it's like he is very like he's very driven by fear in some regards. So,
well, yeah. And it's very,
and also just this whole struggle with like, do I want to be the Messiah? Like the Muad'Dib, like that whole struggle is very human. So,
yeah. Like, well, especially because he's given this idea that the Bene Gesserit. So for you who are listening, the Bene Gesserit, as you see in the first one, we're preparing the way for a Messiah for the Fremen known as the Lisan al-Ghaib, which is, you know, this Messiah type figure who would come and save them from their oppressors. And the arrival of Paul and his mother, Jessica, on the planet of Dune is seen by the people as him coming as the Messiah. And this movie, while that's introduced in the part one, part two is, I would say, 50%, 60, 70% of the movie is about just that, about Paul trying to reject this calling and Lady Jessica and everyone else trying to, in some ways, pull him into this calling that he needs to be this. And part of this goes back to his prescience, where he has these visions of what's going to occur. And Paul, in some ways, is trying to control the future by not letting the future happen, right? The Anakin visions of Padme situation going on, where he's like, I can't let this happen, so I'm gonna do the opposite type thing, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like he's doing two things. He's like trying to control the future, but he's also trying to control his own destiny, where it's like he doesn't want to necessarily fall into this role of the Lisan al-Ghaib. He wants to, like, because it's like he's rejecting that several times in the early part of the movie, where it's like, I'm just want to be a freeman. I want to help these people take their planet back. But he doesn't want to be a messiah. But at the same time, it's like he's trying to control the future and not cause, like he's just trying to prevent genocide.
Right. He doesn't want to be the one who causes millions of people to die. And as his situation moves on, he proceeds to see how much worse it's going to get, right? He has visions of Chani dying, or visions of billions of people dying in various different forms across the galaxy in a war in his name. And that's terrifying to him. And so I do think that his introduction of this aspect of him trying to, be responsible and take on the mantle that was left him by his father and where he's at, frankly, but at the same time, not allowing these wicked things to occur is an interesting aspect to him. I also wanted to note there is this brash brashness about him you see a bit,
yeah.
which is not uncommon in heroes or villains to see some
level of arrogance. Especially young heroes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that as a fan, it was true to the books that he does have these moments where he goes and he does something that in some ways seems very emotional, very unencumbered, which is it's interesting. It's more so interesting, especially in comparison to other groups. I'm going to do a little nerd thing right here just to show the comparison. But there's this group in the books called the Guildsmen that you don't really get to hear or see in the movies. And they generally are in charge of navigation. They have some they have more to deal with spice and traveling through space and stuff like that, right? That's mainly their forte. I'm not going to talk a lot about them, but the point is they have some level of foreknowledge and prescience as well. Because they are so involved with the spice. However, they, seeing these paths forward of what could be, always choose the safe route. And that's what they're known for, is that they do the safe and secure thing to do. And what's notable about Paul is you have this contrast where Paul is this person who has this prescience about what could happen in the future, the different possible outcomes. And he consistently chooses ones that are risky. And so that's that I think provides more contrast in the books. I think it's kind of interesting as part of his personality. And sometimes that causes him to take unnecessary risks, and we'll get to that later, but I just thought that's worth noting. Anyways. Yeah. I think he's very interesting as a character. I think that his development in this movie was really good. I enjoyed it. So did you think the same about the side characters, or? What'd you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the other good thing about these movies in particular. Like this is one of those series where since it's a very political conflict, you have to develop side characters, like give them their own motivations, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. So it's like, and this, it does make sense because these characters have their own motivations, their own drives, their own dreams, their own motives. It's just like every side character like has a reason to be there, more or less. Like you kind of see why they're there, what drives them, what they're doing. Everyone from Stilgar to Chani to Fade Aratha, the Princess Irulene, like everyone has their own reasons, like the goals they're pursuing. And it all comes to a head at the end. Like it all kind of like comes together and you see this conflict take place and how Paul resolves it.
Yeah, I'd agree. And it adds to, this is just part of that universe, right? There's a lot of complex motives between different people, how, you know, Irulene and Shaddam the Fourth are trying to discuss how they can maintain the throne within the Carino house, right? Whereas the Atreides are clearly at this point trying to make a play for the throne. At the same time, you have the Harkonnens, who are allied with the House Carino and the Emperor. They're also in some ways trying to make a play for the throne here. And this doesn't even go into the other houses and how they would have motives here as well. Or the Bene Gesserit a little bit, but not. Anyways, like there's all these different complex things, and so yeah, they play that out well here. At the very least, you have people like Gurney Halleck, who he's clearly motivated by revenge, and he's so motivated by that he's pushing to a certain degree a ideology that he doesn't fully believe, but he wants because he sees it's going to help him achieve his ends of destroying the Harkonnens. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then you have Lady Jessica with her stuff, which I think is interesting because Lady Jessica, they've set up well for the future stories with her. Just because she sees a path forward, right? She goes through the Water of Life trial and she then becomes the Reverend Mother of the Fremen people and has the knowledge of all of the ancestors of this Bene Gesserit line, more or less, which is how kind of a ritual that occurs that most people die in. But if you survive, you take on basically the memories of all of the people who have taken this role before you. So that's what she does. And when she does that, she has all this history to look back on to then plan the future out of. And that's sort of how the prescience, the foreknowledge works in this universe. Is it's not exactly foreknowledge as much as it's like almost like predicting the future in some ways based off of what they've seen in the past, and they're able to do it very, very accurately. So and that's not exactly right, but you know, that's kind of how it works, especially for the Bene Gesserit. What was I trying to say with that? Sorry, I'm gonna be doing factoids, and I need to stop. So,
okay.
Point is,
we were discussing side characters.
Yeah, and Lady Jessica. Well, the point I wanted to make with Lady Jessica before we move on is that Lady Jessica is interesting because she sees this future, right, that she wants for her family and for Paul. And in pushing toward that future, she in some ways alienates Paul from herself, which is – it's interesting because that even though they're allies and even though he's related to her, there's a division between them. And there's even division that continues in some ways in the Atreides household between Lady Jessica and the Atreides line because of how she acts and continues to act moving forward. So it was interesting just because they were related, but they're not even on the same page.
Yeah.
Is there a compelling motive for the protagonist to be involved in this plot? Does Paul have good motive, good reason for being here?
I would say he does kind of stand for an ideal in a way, because it's like, because he is they keep representing him as the Lisan al-Gaib, which is kind of like this messiah figure. So in a way, they keep referencing that, and it's almost like this hope and life for the planet, where it's like freedom from oppression, but also like a new like oceans and green life returning to Arrakis. Like, that's affirmed several times. So it's like maybe not directly an ideal, but it's almost like this hope of something better. Like, maybe that's what he stands for. Like, and even though he kind of rejects it, that's kind of what he stands for in this movie, that he's like this character, like he is hope for a better future.
It's true. And especially the more he takes on the mantle of being the Lisan al-Gaib or the Kwisatz Haderach, which is the same thing, but for the Bene Gesserit, he has more and more motive as time goes on. At first, it's basically like survive or die, right? And as he gets more involved with the Fremen, the more that they see him as a messiah, the more that he sees his role as being responsible for helping to help them out of their oppression from the Harkonnens. And it just gets more, he has more and more reason to stay, more and more reason to be involved, especially as things get worse for the Fremen and they lose the siege and stuff like that. So, yeah, I would say that he had good, compelling reason, and I gave him pretty good points on this. Did you think that the villain or the obstacle in the way of the main character was compelling?
So, I mean, based on this movie alone, I mean, if you combine it with part one, yes. If you just take this movie on its own, it's kind of hard to say yes, only because the villains barely catch a break. Like Harkonnens, it's like they keep losing to Paul and the Fremen. Like, they maybe win once when they destroy the village, like the whole town. Like, when Freyja Roth orders the bombing of the town, and that whole, like, there's all the death, and then they come in and they, like, I guess, loot the place and, like, look for survivors. But, like, that's like their only victory against the Fremen in this movie. Now, this is part two, and if you take into account part one, like, the deaths, like them killing his father, like all the other things that have happened, like they would be more, they're definitely more compelling in that light. But in this movie alone, harder to say.
Yeah.
I mean, Fade Rotha is shown to be more of an interesting new character, especially with him, like his like psychotic fighting in the arena and everything like that. But we barely see that after the fight in the arena. We're just shown him like kind of leading men to fight and like humiliating his brother. We're not really showing him fighting Paul and the Fremen very much. So.
No, and that's true. Honestly, I agree with you. I didn't give them a ton of points for this. And that's one of my disappointments with this movie is because, and I was thinking about this because there's other movies such as, which we have not reviewed, but I think it would be worth at least noting, movies such as V for Vendetta, where the protagonist in that story is one that is pretty consistently fighting off the bad guys, right? And yet I would still say that has some level of compelling buildup, especially in the middle of the movie. And the question is, how do you have that? Now, a lot of that comes from the uncertainty that you have about the outcome. And the more you can build that uncertainty, the more effective you are at building that tension and making people hooked to see what happens next. So the question is either you have to have a very mysterious hero where they're so mysterious you really don't know what they're going to do next, or you have to have uncertainty in regards to their success, which is where the villain and the obstacles in their way are very powerful and very likely to stop them. And I think that's where this one fell short, because there wasn't enough uncertainty about what was going to happen to Paul in a general sense, in that you might not know how the entire plotline is going to play out. What you do know is that he is going to eventually become the Messiah, likely, based on the opener, and he's going to fight his enemies, the Harkonnens, and probably the Emperor, right?
Yeah.
Those are pretty easy extrapolations based off the first 5 minutes, 10 minutes of the movie. And so if us as an audience are seeing that fulfilled, we have to have enough things stacked against us to make us believe that might not actually happen. Because otherwise we're going to default to assume that the story is going to play out as we expect.
But yeah, what carries the movie, though, like, as you said at the beginning, like, it's mostly focused on Paul's struggle of being, do I want to be this Messiah figure? Like, if you really look at the conflict and what's engaging is, like, will his fears happen? Like, will his, like when he sees the visions of genocide, people dying, is that what's going to happen? In a way, we're kind of not really given an answer by the end of the movie, even. So it's hard to say that was the main conflict. Like, you kind of do, but you kind of don't. But
right,
and also because there, I don't want to jump ahead too far. But at the same time, the way this movie ends, it kind of leaves things hanging for another movie. Like, clearly, it's leading to Dune Messiah or something. Like, some things, like, there is some finality, but it's like it's leading into something more. I haven't read the book in a while, and I've only read the first book. I remember the book being more final, the first book, like in the way it ended. So maybe I just, it's just years gone by and I don't remember it very well, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we will get to that. Because I had some thoughts when I first watched it as well. I needed to do some research. So I did. So we'll be sure to cross-check that. But before we get to there, because I do think that this heightening the tension was important, that like you said, Fade Rotha was great in many ways. I think that he was one of those characters that you thought, if he actually comes into contact with him, this could be a problem. And when he happens at the end, I thought that was, there was some tension there that was good. Vladimir Harkonnen is also a compelling villain, I think, in some ways. He wasn't really utilized in this movie, though, which is kind of a waste. So I don't think that he was as effective as he could have been. And then the Water of Life. That was another point that was kind of central, like you said, to that internal conflict of, is he going to take on this role of the Messiah? Does center around taking this poison and becoming a man who takes on this ritual that only women took on because only women ever survived. And the... those were all interesting, but other characters like Mother Gaia, Helena, who was the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother from the first one, who was originally in some ways an enemy, is not really playing much of an enemy role in this one. The Emperor Shaddam the Fourth doesn't even really play that much of a threat. Irulene doesn't play much of a threat. Rabban even doesn't really play much of a threat. And so a lot of these characters were not as effective as I think they could have been. And here's a point I do want to bring up from the story. Actually, I'll bring it up in the next question, which is about the did I miss something? No, I didn't. Okay, yeah, about the world-shattering loss. Was there world-shattering loss in this story?
I guess in a way, and I'm not, it depends on how you interpret the ending, I guess, is the other thing. It's just like, does he lose Chani at the end compared to the, like, because in the book he doesn't, but in the movie it's clear, like, she's walking off alone because he's agreed to marry the Emperor's daughter to kind of create an alliance, more or less to create a peace and to, well, like, to create a, well, yeah.
Yeah.
To more or less gain power and to establish the Fremen more in the whole conflict. So,
yeah.
Though it sets him against the other houses.
I think that's going to be more of like the twist at the end, or what's supposed to be the twist at the end was that. I wouldn't say that that was like a moment of world-shattering loss necessarily.
Yeah.
We could discuss that. I overall said no. And yeah. I think that that's
I mean, if you don't count that, then I'd say no too, because I can't think of anything that would be world-shattering loss. Like, he doesn't lose very much in this movie. So he loses a lot in the first movie, but not in this one.
Right. And so let me throw at you a little bit of something that they took out from the book that I think they should not have. And I hate to be one of those guys like, oh, they didn't follow the book, it's so bad. But the reason that it's important that they didn't follow the book in this place, and there's other things they took out that I was okay with, right? Mm-hmm. Count Fenring is a character in the books that was a very influential character to the Emperor. He plays a big role in some of the books. He's kind of an important figure, especially because he was an attempt at the Kwisatz Haderach by the Bene Gesserit earlier on. They took him out. I don't really care, because at the end of the day, this is the only book he shows a major role in for a while. Doesn't actually affect as much as I think he needs to. I was fine with Dennis taking that out. The thing that they took out that I have a problem with is they took out Paul Atreides' first son. Paul Atreides has a son with Shani called Leto II the Elder. And this is significant because there is a raid on the Siege, and in that raid, two things happen. One, his sister, also in the books, his sister isn't in the womb the entire time. She gets born and she becomes like 2 years old, and she's a freaky 2-year-old because she has consciousness because of her mother drinking the water of life when she was pregnant. So it awoke Aaliyah, Paul's sister, Jessica's daughter, when she was still in the womb. She becomes conscious, and then she is born, and she's a 2-year-old walking around with a fully developed brain, more or less. And
she acts like an adult in some ways.
Yeah, it's creepy, and that's part of the point. But so in the books, she gets captured. That's one of the two things that happens. The second thing that happens is that Paul's son dies. Paul's infant son dies. And that's a significant loss for him. That's part of the reason that propels him forward into the story. And I think that's a perfectly strong motivating reason for Paul to be uniting the tribes, to take on the mantle, and all of those other things. I think that's a very strong motive for him moving forward. And so I'm really confused why they took that out specifically, probably because of time. They thought that they needed to add other things. But of all things to cut, that is, I think, one of the more emotionally heart-pulling things you could have kept in. So
I completely forgot about that till you mentioned that, but you're right. Like, my brain, like, I remember that now that you've said that.
Yeah. And it's a big deal. It's like a big deal to him. It's a big deal to her. You know, so I think in regards to world shattering loss, he didn't have one in the movie, but he should have, because it was right there in the books waiting for you. So, you know, that's a big L on the director and writer's parts. Do better. Anyways, that's all I have to say on that specifically. Revelations. Did you think that there was a revelation in this movie that changed everything?
Technically, yes, but it's not clear in this movie how it affects things, I guess. So,
Go ahead.
I mean, I'm talking about thing. So, like, the reveal that Paul and his mother are actually related to the Harkonnens is supposed to be a big deal. I feel like in relation to the plot and storyline, it had very little impact in this movie. Like, it had only a minimal impact. It does change things in regards to their relationship, but does it have world-shattering impacts? I don't know. It doesn't. I mean, at this point, it's hard to say. Like, you indicated that it might have bigger impacts in future stories. So maybe in a future movie, if they get that far, it'll have bigger impacts. But for now, it doesn't mean much of anything.
Yeah. No.
So, and it's like finding out, this person's your long-lost cousin. Oh, cool. Like, that's literally what it is.
Fun fact.
Like, it's just like, that's what it comes across as.
Yeah. That is true. The yeah, and for Paul Atreides, it really doesn't play a strong role. Like you indicated, mm-hmm. or like I said earlier to you before we started this podcast, that does have a significant effect later on in the series. And so if they choose to make these books continue into movies, mm-hmm. That's great to set that seed now for setting up what's going to happen. But mm-hmm. by itself in this movie, it doesn't mean anything other than, like you said, a fun fact. And I think that's one of the problems with some revelations, is just because more information doesn't mean or a plot twist in and of itself doesn't mean anything. A plot twist mm-hmm. is only good if it actually affects the plot. And yeah, in this
it
case,
it has to have actual meaning to it that affects the here and now. Like, it has to, like, the audience has to hear it, to see it, and understand, okay, this changes things. Like, this changes the values of what's going on. This changes, like, the direction the story is going, or something like that. Like, it has to have clear implications in the moment of the story. Like, it could be, like, the bend in the road or the crossroads that we have to make a decision now. Or it makes us realign our, like, oh, do we actually root for this person anymore right now or not? It's just one of those things. That's what a plot twist should do. But it's not just information. It's not just fun facts and trivia.
Right. Right. Like, for example, in Pirates of the Caribbean, you have the Elizabeth Swan being stolen by the pirates. And they say, oh, you know, we're going to take you, whatever. And they spill her blood on the gold, and then nothing happens. And then you get the revelation that they are looking for the bloodline of the Turners, because mm-hmm. one of the few in their crew who needs to have their blood spilled is the one that they actually got rid of, which was Bootstrap Bill, who was William Turner, the elder. And so that that revelation changes a lot, not just because it's, oh, fun fact, Will Turner is related to this pirate dude. It's, oh, Will Turner's dad was the key to breaking this curse. And now Will Turner becomes a critical part of this storyline. And in some ways, mm-hmm. they foreshadow that and other things. So it's not like...
Yeah. But it, well, no, it still doesn't come out of nowhere, but yeah.
Right. It's still an important revelation that changes a lot about how the story progresses. This is not that kind of revelation. Mm-hmm. And that's why they didn't get that much from me on that point. Knockout surprise ending. Nat, I know you were just mentioning that before. The idea of Chaney.
Chani. Yeah. So, I mean, they do hint at it in the movie. That, and if you've read the book, you see it coming. You already know mm-hmm. that he's going to make this political marriage to the emperor's daughter. But to someone who hasn't read the book, I could see it being a surprise. So it's like, oh, it almost comes out of, like, it could come out of nowhere and be a surprise. Like, oh, like, he suggests it. And it makes logical sense even in the scene. You see how it makes sense. But it's also like a betrayal, an emotional way. You see, because it's almost like he's betraying Chani, but he also keeps saying he loves her. So it's almost like, for the audience, it would be a surprise ending if they aren't familiar with the books, possibly.
Right. Well, especially in an environment where, oh, love trumps all. You do, you marry mm-hmm. who you love and all of that. The idea that this political arrangement was being made by Paul for the sake of what he saw as, oh, this is going to help bring peace to the galaxy by mm-hmm. making this political arrangement. Makes, I think, a little less sense to some people. I think it was a good move. I don't think I had a problem with it. I actually preferred how they did it in the movie compared to the book on this one. Because in the book, more or less, Paul explains this all to Chani, and he's like, oh, I still love you the most, don't worry. And then Jessica's like, oh, he still loves you the most, don't worry. And she more or less just goes along with it. Versus in this one, the fact that she's upset about it is very clear, and in some ways has more of an emotional pull, I think, than it does in the books. And to be honest, this is another point where I think if they had kept his son in, it would have had even more of an emotional pull. because it's literally, you literally have this moment where it's like, okay, you love this girl. You had a child with this girl. Clearly this is the right person for you. And then you go and you reject her in some ways for the sake of this political arrangement. How could you even do that? And I think that that would have been more effective. And, you know, it's like just that one small thing they decided to cut. Well, not a, maybe literally small thing, but not that was a big part of the books in some ways, not in just because of the emotional fact of it. And I think they wasted that potential again.
Yeah.
Don't want to belabor that. I just think it's worth noting. Shame. Transformation. I think transforming characters are really important to me. I think it shows a lot of about great characters when you see that growth. Did you see that growth in this movie?
Yes. Paul does change over the course of the movie. Like, he is more he becomes a leader at the end of the book, where it's like he definitely has more confidence, more courage. And he's like, he's taking the lead, the initiative at the end of the story, as opposed to like just trying to avoid certain outcomes, like just trying to integrate with everyone else. Because that's what it looks like he's doing more or less at the beginning of the movie, like trying to integrate into the Fremen culture, not really taking a leading stance. Whereas at the end of the story, he's clearly leading. He's got making the decisions. He's telling people what to do. And it's like he's taking on, he has embraced the role of Lisan Al Gaib. He's like, yes, this is who I am now.
Yeah. And it is good, especially with, I will say it happens a little early in the story. So you have him, you know, have this emotional turmoil. And then after the Siege Tubber is attacked, he proceeds to take the Water of Life. And from that point forward, he's pretty committed to his role as the Lisan Al Gaib, the Kwisatz Haderach, and his role in taking down the Harkonnens, overthrowing the House Carino, and becoming the ruler of the universe. So my only problem with it is once he's taken that elixir, there is no development from there, and he's pretty much... he's pretty much stagnant from that point forward, and that you still have like a good hour left in the movie. So it's like, I don't know. I think that it was a little early. I wish they would have tried to do at least something else with it. What exactly that looks like, I don't know. I still gave it full points for this, 'cause I think it will still a good development arc, right? He's trying to not make a decision in this, and then he realizes he's being forced to make a decision. And at the end of the day, he's faced with a trolley situation. And what does he decide to do? He pulls the lever. So there you go, people. If you want to deal with your psychology class or your ethics class, Paul suggests a solution. Anyways. Does this movie have a theme or a message that it's conveying?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say out of the ashes, hope rises. I mean, something like that. That'd be a pretty accurate theme for this movie. Just because like, of how low he's brought and out of that hope. Like, he's brought into the, like, his whole family and the Atreides family line is like almost destroyed, obliterated. He's sent into the desert. He's like disappeared. And it's like out of the ashes, he comes back as the Messiah with an army, and he takes back like the whole, like he takes on the emperor and practically wins in some regards, though he has to settle with the great houses still. But he's gained a place among the higher echelons of power in the universe.
Right. I did think that there was something along those lines, something about the idea of the calling in your life or destiny and being active in that was what was coming to mind for me. So I would say there are some themes. I think you can argue that it's messy, so it's not clear. I'd be willing to grant that. But overall, you know, there's definitely, especially in the movie version, because the book is long and winding. The movie in this case is actually more clear, I would say, on that kind of thing, which is,
Well, the movie is still a slow build in some scenes. I was like, it's not like action packed or anything. Like boom, boom, boom. It's just like there are some character development. I think there's even some scenes in this movie that weren't in the book. like, because I think they did more to show, like, Paul's development among the Fremen and even his relationship with Chani that weren't in the book, I think.
Yeah, like the wind, the moisture, yeah. Wick nets or whatever they are, yeah. Yeah, for sure they there's some things that are definitely part of the book, like the grandfather worm that he rides and whatnot. But yeah, as a general rule, and I didn't have creative license issues with any of that. Mm-hmm. I didn't either.
Yeah.
In regards to the ending, before I get too far out, I know you said there were some things you were curious about in the end. I thought that there was a couple things that stuck out to me. I thought for one, well, go ahead and say what your concerns were, what you weren't sure of before I just...
Well, no, I'm just trying to remember how the book ends in regards to the conflict. Because I don't remember, like, this war with the Great Houses being, like, incoming or whatever. I just got the impression that things were finalized or something. So when I read the first book, I wasn't, like, motivated to, like, oh, I need to read the second one. Like, what's going to happen next? I got this feeling like, okay, this is how the story went. This is, like, almost like it was all said and done. More or less when I read the book, which is not the impression you get when you watch this movie, which is like, oh, there's still something coming, there's more, like there's a war coming, like there's battle, like it's like it gives you that impression that there's more to come.
So that, like, that is true.
Part three.
Yes, so that was a thing I was curious about too, because when I recalled reading this, I had the same thing, and having read the second book, you do not see a holy war go on in book two. So, Dune Messiah doesn't have that, right? Where is this coming from? And what are they going to do in the next movie? Right, because clearly there's going to be a part three. Probably going to be part of the... well, it's going to be the next book, because unless you just decide to go in your own complete direction, which hopefully they don't do that. But, you know, there's the Dune Messiah, which is the next story, is very different from having a holy war. And so I at first was, because I thought the same thing. I reread the end just to be sure what happens. What happens is that message is sent up to the other great houses who have arrived above Dune, and they say, don't land, otherwise we're going to blow up all spice on this planet, which is significant because that's how they travel, and the only way to harvest it is through this planet, Dune. So don't go anywhere, like, don't do anything, otherwise you guys won't be able to travel in the near future. And that is all you hear. You don't hear anything else. You don't hear that they say yes, you don't hear that they say no. That's just what happens. And so my understanding when I read the books, which I haven't read the first book in a while, I've read most of the other ones fairly recently, within the past 2 or 3 years, right? So the first one had been a while. I had to refresh on that. Dune Messiah, based on my quick research before I started this, is the understanding is that that jihad war does occur, but it occurs between book one and book two.
Interesting.
Huh. Yes. So the jihad, the holy war, does occur, but it doesn't occur in our understanding of the storyline. Like, it doesn't happen in a way that we see it. So because the whole thing just follows the next book is very political as well, and about assassination attempts and whatnot, so it's spoiler alert, but you know, it's very interesting because the way that they end it, it looks like what we're going to see next in the next movie is this grand epic space war that's about to go on across the galaxies, and that's just not really what the books are about. So maybe we'll see a montage of that occurring. Maybe we won't. Personally, and this is like a little bit of a spoiler, but I don't think that prophecy that, okay, this, I don't think that prophecy that Paul has about all those people dying is about all those people starving and whatnot, is about the holy war. But
okay,
I could be wrong on my interpretation of that, and you should read the books if you want to find out what I do think it is, and you will then know. But yeah, that's all I wanted to say on that. Yeah. And the other thing about the ending, which I wanted to point out, is that Fade Rotha, the battle with Fade Rotha was totally unnecessary, but totally part of Paul's character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a point that they make in the
it
book.
It is in the book, though.
It is in the book.
Oh,
and
okay.
And that's the point that the book makes, is that everyone is wondering why he does this fight. But part of that is the brashness of Paul and how he takes these unnecessary risks because he perceives it as a risk worth taking. And the question is there something he saw in his vision that saw this battle must occur? Or is this something simply something he did because he decided to take that risk? We don't know. And that's part of the point, is that Paul is this man who's willing to take these risks that other people are not willing to take. That he gets emotional about things and takes action in some ways, whereas other people who have this foresight carefully plan and scheme and try to be very cool and collected about it. So the way that he uses his foreknowledge is very different compared to other people. And I thought I think it's a great addition. I enjoyed it. And it was one of the better scenes in the movie for sure.
Yeah, I could see that. I enjoyed the fight scene. It's very well. I mean, all the fight scenes in this movie are very well planned out. Mm-hmm. And some of them are very entertaining and like kind of cool to watch, especially the sword play and some scenes.
Right.
And I get what you're saying. Actually, a funny thought just occurred to me. Like, maybe he thought to prevent Fade Rotha's any children from being born or something, but which would be kind of funny. But
I mean, it is true that Fade Rotha is one of the potential candidates to create the Kwisatz Haderach for the Bene Gesserit. So
Yeah. You
know, his bloodline and Paul's bloodline were both significant for the Bene Gesserit's purposes. And in that way, if Paul saw that, it could be a reason why he killed him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyways, were you satisfied? Do you want to see the next one?
I was definitely very satisfied with this movie. Clearly, they're leading up for another one. And I'm going to guess, based on what you just said about the Holy War stuff, maybe that scene was just put in to get fans excited, or people, non-fans, excited for a third movie. It's like, oh, there's something cool coming after this movie. After all, I mean, like...
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, just to get excitement up. So, I mean, it, just for the Zendaya fans out there, she has a bigger role in this movie. Like, she doesn't have just 10 minutes of screen time like in the first one. So you get to see more of your favorite actress, I guess.
When we walked out of the theaters, there was a couple other people who walked out and they said, man, there wasn't enough fight scenes in that one. And so, you know, the ending, they go, oh no, there might be more fight scenes. And then... they'll pull the curtain. Turns out there's no fight scenes in part three. That'd be hilarious. I don't know. It might be. I'm sorry, you guys who were looking forward to the fighting. There's some good fight scenes if you haven't watched it, but I wouldn't say that they made excessively long fight scenes in this compared to some other movies who are known for having long fight scenes, you know, Gladiator or, Star Wars episode 2, 3, 1, you know, like those, you're not going to have something like that. A lot of those scenes were more concise and to the point. The Sardaukar mm-hmm. do next to nothing in this movie. So what can I say? But yeah, that's it. That is the pod. We hope you all enjoyed. We sure did. And as always, we look forward to seeing you back with us next time next week. Same time next week. That's right. We're out.